Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sorts of ideas, emotions, and even political agendas can be conveyed through modern dance? And what keeps the art form as relevant today as it ever has been? My guest this hour is responsible for some of its evolution. Bill T. Jones is co-founder of the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company, which has produced hundreds of works since its creation just over a quarter of a century ago. He's been honored as a MacArthur Genius Fellow, and his awards include a Dorothy and Lillian Gish Prize, Wexner Prize, Obie and Tony Awards. He's scheduled to speak tonight at 8 at the Nasher Salon event in Dallas, and we're delighted that he would make time for us this afternoon. Bill, welcome to Think.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
You've talked about your work, your approach to dance, really, as moving sculpture. What does that mean to you?
Well, I've had to define my approach to dance in so many different ways over so many different periods, but let's go back to the formalist one that you just outlined. Sculpture has always intrigued me because it was when I maybe was standing in front of a Henry Moore or something, and someone said, relate to the sculpture as if you were meeting a person. Literally, the size of the sculpture was not that far from my own size. There was a sense of a presence. I could walk around it, and walking around it means there's a kind of a time comes into play. And I realized that this was very appealing to me. So when I began to make dances, Arnie Zane and I began to make dances, we were really interested in what space is and how space affects personality, how space affects gesture. What are the power politics of space? If you've ever been on the stage and they tell you, sitting in the audience, where's the most powerful place on the stage? You might think right down front, sitting on the edge of the stage is powerful. But a good performer can go all the way to the back of the stage, and because they are so aloof and distant, they will immediately pull focus. So sculpture also has that ability about it. That is sculpture in the large sense of space. Now, in terms of shape, what the human body is able to do in terms of gesture. A gesture, I personally, in my own dancing, tend toward the heroic gesture. That's something that modern dance is known for, I guess dance in general. Gesture that probably was originally inflected and influenced by looking at sculpture.
When you say heroic, you mean big and grand?
Yes. Gesture that has a kind of sweep to it, maybe has an implied narrative, a protagonist. Some idea is being suggested through the way that the arms and legs are arranged. That is not the postmodern way, of course. The postmodern way, when I was dancing in that way early on in New York, many people would say, oh, this guy, what's with him? He's such a showboat. Because the postmodern way of thinking about dance was that dance should be a pedestrian activity. There should not be a wall between the performer on the stage and the person sitting in the chairs. As a matter of fact, the most beautiful gestures were considered the everyday. This was very much in currency somewhere in the late 50s through maybe the 60s. The idea of natural movement, natural in scale. That which was sometimes ephemeral movement, something it didn't really look like what a ballet dancer would do, which is ultimately what we mean when we say dance oftentimes. It could be just a person walking, sitting, the way an arm is extended or the opposite of that. These two worlds, this heroic, grand theatrical gesture and this world of the everyday, the commonplace, have always been two poles of interest for me as a choreographer. Which one has the most ability to move people? Which one can communicate, and these are ironic questions, which one can communicate the greatest truth? I think right now we live in an era where people, quite frankly, oftentimes want escape. And therefore, they want to see what Martha Graham, the great Martha Graham, described as acrobats of God. They don't want to see the girl or boy next door. But what does the artist want to do?
Well, as an artist, I'm curious because if you were sculpting clay or bronze or anything else, you have an implied degree of control based on your skill. Mm-hmm. Once you place something, it's there forever. As a choreographer, you're working with living, breathing human beings who have
sublime
their
materials, I sometimes call them.
But they must be both sublime and frustrating, and I suppose that's part of the process.
That's it. And I say that this is not a job; it's a calling. In my more elevated moments, yes, the people who are there oftentimes are very young as well. Let's not forget that. Dance is brutal. Dance is it's a physical thing. The joints, the back, the gravity. It's the domain of young, oftentimes athletic bodies. It's grueling. Doesn't mean that you have to stop dancing as you get older, but you have to change your relationship to gravity when you get older. And yes, they are oftentimes, the dancers are confused. They don't know a lot about themselves. They're involved in an art form that's not highly prized by the culture. It is quite marginalized in some ways. So they are victims of a lot of self-criticism. In the classic sense, and I mean even in the sense of classical modern dance, the dancer comes into a studio and there is a great teacher. And the teacher can be, hopefully, a sensitive human being who wants to pull out of you the best. Or the teacher can be a screaming, neurotic drill sergeant. And this was, I believe, in the early days of modern dance, almost required. When you work with those giants, such as Ms. Graham or Lemon or people like that, you were coming to study at the feet of some genius. And you had to, in some ways, give yourself completely to them. Now, we live in a generation now where young people, sometimes frustratingly, come out of a conservatory and they think they know already everything there is to know. They studied it in school. And they are auditioning you as you're auditioning them. And I sometimes joke and I say, well, when a young dancer comes in the company, sometimes I feel they think that I'm in their movie. And they don't know they're supposed to be in my movie.
Well, I have to wonder, is there a period where a young dancer comes out of the conservatory and has to really give up expressing himself or herself, because suddenly you're the medium for...
Well, when did they start? Well, if they've been in the conservatory, they've been given assignments. Mm-hmm. They haven't yet proven anything. They haven't actually... They've been in apprenticeship. When did they start, quote, expressing this self that's probably 18 or 19 years old?
I suppose people have been expressing themselves all along. But you know
well,
what I mean?
Well, people have been being all along. Self-expression is something that when you spend enough time doing it and being criticized, and you realize the incredible heights that self-expression has been taken to since art was defined as art, and incidentally it wasn't always done that way, I think you have humility that comes into it. I was surprised in touring in Asia in the 1980s that such a low premium was placed on what we call innovation. There, a young artist is expected to be an apprentice and hope that you can emulate a tradition that came before you. It's here in the West that we've placed a high premium on everybody is supposed to be an original. Everybody is supposed to have something unique to say. There are many cultures that don't really value individuality and originality. We've found out what works. Can you do it well? And if you are a master, maybe someday you'll be able to change some small part of that. But I'm sorry, I digress. I'm not letting you make your...
Question is an artist still an artist if they are functioning as someone who is following the direction of another artist? In other words, if you're the choreographer and you've created this dance, mm-hmm. are the dancers who are working for you, are they artists in their own right, or are they functioning to serve your art because you've innovated what they're doing?
Well, they are creative artists and they're interpretive artists. Mm-hmm. In a classical sense, right? I mean, my classical music friends, for instance, the people at the Orion String Quartet who we worked with some years ago from Lincoln Center Chamber Music Project, and or Nurit Patch, who I believe comes from Houston. They always speak of serving the music. Now, it just so happens they may be serving a person who's been dead for 200 years, but they're serving the music. It's different with dance, and you're right. But I think dancers have to be clear, particularly with a living choreographer, that they're going to come into a situation and they're going to place their skill, even their sensibility, at the service of a vision. Now, my company, I'm glad to say we create an environment that everyone is asked to contribute to. And I borrow something from, Zen Buddhism, the idea of fresh mind. And that notion was that even you can learn from the youngest person in the room, because there's something unadorned, unjaded about their commitment to what they're doing. Everyone can learn. When we, in my company, sit down, and we do sit down and talk about things a lot, everyone can have a voice. And then when we are up on our feet, we're trying to find solutions to problems. This is the hallmark of the postmodern world that I was a product of. It is oftentimes problem solving. My job is not always to have all the answers. My job is to articulate the correct questions. And that is when it gets really exciting. People, when they feel invested, they have made this bit of material. Maybe they've never made anything before, and now they have to teach it to everyone. And then it becomes part of the fabric of an organization that's now in its 25th year. An organization that's had some really fabulous dancers on stage, and an organization that hopes to go on for another 25 years. So they're now a part of a living institution. Is everyone's ego properly acclimated to the reality of that? Where does the buck stop? It is Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane Dance Company. Arnie and I used to joke and say, this is an open environment for working, but it's not a democracy. When the critic writes, this work does not work, they don't say that Sally such and so made a bad phrase. They say this director was not on the mark on this, and that's my name. So that's my job, to make sure that it's very clear what we're doing there. They have entered into a contract where they are part of a vision of which I am the figurehead of. I ask the questions, but I do not have all the answers.
You lost Arnie Zane, who was your partner in life as well as your partner in the dance company,
yes, in 1988.
I'm wondering if you've thought over the years about the parts of yourself that you had to develop that you might not have if you'd still had him, simply because there were things that he did that you didn't have to do, that you didn't have to think about.
Well, you're almost repeating back to me something I had said for so many years, particularly in the first 10 years after his death, about the nature of grief. And people would ask me, how do you deal with grief? And I used to say, identify the qualities in the person that you have lost and try to find those in yourself, not to become them, but what are the qualities? Well, you ask me, I'm not sure if I'll try answering it this way. Arnie had a great visual sense. He had a tremendous work ethic. He was very organized. I have had to develop my visual sense. By nature, I'm very emotional. I'm not a list maker. I'm not very systematic or scientific. I've had to learn how to be that. And I think that he had a great sense of confidence in his doing. Even though I am an improviser by nature, and I have, someone once said to me, a natural forward momentum as a performer, I'm full of doubt, always second-guessing myself. That's something that I think if he was still around, I would not have developed those qualities.
My guest is choreographer Bill T. Jones. We will talk to him a bit more after this break. You can join us today by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. You can learn more about Bill T. Jones' appearance tonight at nashersalonseries.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is choreographer Bill T. Jones, a co-founder of the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company and multi-award winner. He's in town to address tonight's Nasher Salon at the Nasher Sculpture Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Bill, how much is thinking time part of what you do?
I think too much. I'm a great obsessor, waking up in the middle of the night, and suddenly there is a problem. And is the problem a formal one, something I'm stuck in this piece, or is it some choice I have to make about what I'm going to do with the nature of the company or a career choice? And everything, be it in the newspapers or what have you, has to go through this process, sort of moral intellectual process that's like a wheel churning in my head and in my heart. And I'm sometimes worn out by it. The moments that I love are when you are in the studio and what I am thinking and what I am doing are one. The moments of lying flat in my bed, on my back, and thinking in the abstract can sometimes just be exhausting for me.
How do you claw through all those different things you're thinking about and decide what is worthy of being made into art and what is maybe just something that sort of colors the way you're working at that moment?
Well, it's amazing that what I'm thinking at 3 o'clock in the morning suddenly coalesces at the strangest moment in the studio, and suddenly, oh, that's what that meant, this question I was asking myself. Now here's time to apply it. And this is a way of saying it's not a conscious process. I just have to be ready. I really do feel that I am at any one moment a crossroads for many different impulses. Some of them bubble to the surface, and do I have the wherewithal, the calmness to grab them at that moment? And then in my company rehearsal process, articulate this idea, throw it into the air, and then others grab it. And then suddenly it belongs to us. And then it begins to have byproduct. Now my second job is to begin to make choices about what the byproducts are in the room. So it went from something I hope to talk about here in the Nasher Salon tonight, this internal space, this cave, if you will, choose your metaphor, or maybe it's a beautiful garden. Sometimes it feels like a cave, that a sense of identity and questions originate. And then this beautiful, bright line that maybe comes through the eyes and through the head, but I like to think of it coming through the chest, out into the world, connecting with the world. That is what I am depending on to always be there when I set about making something or when I have to make a choice. It's not scientific at all. It verges on almost a religious feeling.
You do not seem to approach dance as a form of entertainment to the extent that you're doing it thinking what will necessarily please the crowd. I mean, I'm wondering, though, you have to think about what the audience will really comprehend and how far you can take them from what's in your head to what you really want to convey. How do you work that in, knowing that your audience may be very familiar with what they're seeing, or it may be an art form that they don't consume all the time?
Well, I always assume, and maybe I shouldn't, I always assume people don't really know a lot about dancing. And sometimes it makes me a little didactic in explaining things. But let's look at, let's contrast two pieces. Chapel Chapter, the work that's going to be premiered on the
28th
in Houston at Jones Hall, is a work that really was almost supposed to be a throwaway work. And it's turned out to be a very, very important work for the company. Very tough subject matter. About various types of death and murder, child with parents, a kind of a mass murder, and a very curious child suicide. It's much more beautiful than I'm making it sound, but it stands for a certain type of exploration that was designed to give the audience an experience that they had to grapple with. The next work that I'm making right now is called Quarreling Pair, which is based on a kind of a surrealist, odd puppet play, and we decided to set it in a vaudeville show. It's very tongue-in-cheek. We do clowning. We do all these things, which once upon a time we would have considered completely uncool. But it's because I really want it for myself and my company. Can we make people laugh? Can we have a good time? Ultimately, I have a very serious purpose. The end of the piece is very different than the beginning. But that first 45 minutes, we have to give ourselves to entertainment mode. I don't want prejudice in any way in myself or around me. So as much as I know that there's a lot of dumb stuff that is sold to people now as entertainment, there can be also something community building in people laughing together, in artists not taking themselves so seriously that they can't look into the eyes of that person in the front row and realize the person in the front row is saying, well, I'm giving you my attention, but what are you giving me? Or this feeling of superiority that comes sometimes when if they don't get it, it must be good. You know. So I am trying to stay open to that which is entertaining. But I don't want to be dominated by hitting a home run and making a big splash, commercial splash all the time. That is another industry, you know, that I've worked on Broadway, and it's about making a product that will sell. And that's great because I want to have a good life and I want my dancers to have a good life. But we also are in something which is like a spiritual activity. And for those persons in the audience listening to us, you know, when you meditate, when you engage in anything that has an unclear objective, you run the risk sometimes of going to very dark places, very troubling places. And then sometimes you come into places that are exhilarating because of the light that is there. But you've got to work. I think highly about art. I think highly of art, and I believe that that's what it can do at its best. But I also want people to trust contemporary dance. Modern dance makes me cringe when we say that because everyone thinks, oh, this is something like medicine. It's good for me. I don't like it. But contemporary dance is dance made in your time and hopefully is made with a generous spirit and a knowing spirit. I know that you people in the audience have a lot of options. You could be in a movie tonight. You could be listening to a CD. You could be doing any number of things. Why are you here with me? I want you to know that I'm thinking about you. And maybe I have a moment that is there just to help you relax, just to build a bridge between us. There's no shame in that. Because the places I want you to go with me may not be easy, but you've got to trust me that I understand our contract.
Choreographer Bill T. Jones is my guest. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Bill, is there a different kind of focus on the way something is moved or the way it is danced if the focus is really very much on the narrative as opposed to something that is just created for the way it looks?
Well, the world of dance that I came into was very biased against narrative. It was, as a matter of fact, there's a famous quotation, and I want to do him justice, but I understand that John Cage said to a young – John Cage, the great experimental composer, said to a young Merce Cunningham, who was dancing with Martha Graham at that time, oh, you must leave her. She's become too literary. In other words, there's an assumption that all art forms should find what is essential to them and that they succeed best at, and they should go in pursuit of that. And I believe that's why in the 20th century there was such a premium placed on abstraction. For instance, in painting is about a two-dimensional surface. It's not about trying to an illusion that wants to pretend that it is a photograph or a sculpture. It's about that. What does painting do well? It does hue, it does line, it does color. The same was said about dance. What does dance do? Dance is not about pretending to be anything other than human beings moving bravely and resourcefully through space. Do not pretend to be a princess. Do not try to pretend that you're in a movie or on television. Do not pretend that you are telling a story. Novels do that better than you. This was the bias of the time. Now, of course, I live in an era where everything is allowed now and people can mix everything up, and I mix up as well. I am constantly trying to understand, in fact, how I can extend the stage into areas that might be more understood as film, might be understood as photography, might be understood literally sometimes as commentary. I'm a great one for just turning to the audience and talking. You know, now I might be talking about something very tangible in the world, but behind me, the dancers are doing something curious and abstract. Now, the audience is probably working like mad to make a connection between this linear, reasoned statement I'm making and that thing that these people behind me are doing. And I say, in that instance, the event is greater than the sum of its parts. My companion often says he thinks that my work is best compared to maybe a combine of Robert Rauschenberg. When you look at a Robert Rauschenberg and here you have an object found in the garbage, here you have a bit of what looks like abstract expressionist painting, there is maybe a bit of newsprint. What are you to make of it? I think that he really encourages us to recreate the work, to get in there and make our own connections. And I think that's really liberating and very good for us.
Well, when you look at a work like a Rauschenberg, you are drawn to get closer and see what each individual part is, and then you sort of step back. And I think that happens as well when you're looking at dance, because
unfortunately, it moves by so fast.
There's everything that goes quickly.
Yes.
But I'm wondering, even about the, you know, you talk about abstraction, about the individuals, because no matter how much a piece may not be about someone's size or shape or gender or color, you, except with really extreme costuming, you can't get rid of that.
No, you're right. You're right. And this was the battle in the culture wars in the late 80s and 90s about what. Who was allowed to be on stage? What was the contract with the audience? Do I want you to forget the fact that you are looking at a person on stage who maybe has one leg? We will all agree that we're not supposed to see that you have one leg. Or do I actually want you to know that you're looking at a person on stage who has one leg and that is, in fact, part of what's going on? There's a great deal of discomfort about that. Or someone on stage has let you know that they have breast cancer. And maybe you see that she has a scar. You think, well, why doesn't she cover that up? I just want to look at the beauty of her dancing. And she will say, well, can't you still see the beauty of my dancing and with me with this scar? I think that's provocative. I think now her skill as a dance movement maker and a dancer, I hope that is also in evidence. The other thing I believe just raises the ante. There was, for many years, there was a question about should blacks be in ballet? Because it was said by people who were well-meaning people, well, look, the black dancers, their buttocks are too high. The feet are not flexible enough. And if you have a row of swans, you don't want one swan that is brown. You want them all to be the same color. Well, you know, there's something... I guess I could argue if this is a classical art form and these are its values, maybe that's true. But I also think we live in an era now where the audience is more sophisticated. They know that we are always, in some level, saying, pretend. Or can you, how many different levels at which can you enter into this picture? So, yes, I have had Larry Goldhuber on stage at 300 plus pounds. And yes, I have had people on stage who were trained since they were 3 years old with great extension. They looked, quote, like dancers. But I found it rich and wonderful when Larry and this person were on stage dancing together. Then it became a metaphor of the world that I want to live in. And Arnie Zane and I always said that. The company should look like a microcosm of the world that we hope to live in. Many different types of people. People who obviously have a little dissonance between them, literally in their training or maybe their approach to movement, but they are on stage really struggling to be together. Now, that seems to be, in the time of our election right now, a big fight that we're having. What am I willing to do to coexist with you? And what is the goal? What is the prize, to use the civil rights jargon? What is the eye on the prize? So keep a stage full of variation, as full as you can. Keep it full of surprises in terms of the things that are happening, one thing following another. Do it with generosity. Make it very well designed, well lit, seductive to the eye. And now ask the audience to come into it as they come into any modern urban environment right now, where you meet all sorts of people, all sorts of ideas are coming at you. The same skills that you have to master in being a good citizen in that society, are related to the skills that will allow you to enjoy a performance which is full of people of many different body types, many styles of movement, lots of information coming at you. I think you need a still center in yourself. You need to know what you're about. And then you can be generous, I think, in looking into such a world.
Well, you are doing that as the choreographer. You're hoping that the audience can come to the performance with that. I'm wondering how much, though, reverberates back to the dancers themselves, who famously have these love-hate relationships with their highly toned, highly trained bodies, which still don't always do everything they want them to do.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about just that question. What is a good dancer? And what do you have to be? What kind to be a virtuoso in this style of movement? By the time they get on stage, there's an incredible complicity. People have rehearsed this movement. They have cried in the studio. And they are hopefully proud of what they're doing. And they believe in me. And I say, you're beautiful. And we go out and we offer this thing. And then we oftentimes have post-performance discussions. And they can hear when the audience says, oh, I think you guys were great. Or they can hear when the audience says, well, you know, I just didn't get what you were doing. They know what the engagement is. And I say, this is what a life in the arts is. Is it enough for you? Is it satisfying to you? I can never make them happy. I can never make them love themselves more, but I can ask them to be honest about their engagement and what they're doing and how they stand, where they stand in the body they have.
My guest is choreographer Bill T. Jones. He's in town to address the Nasher Salon tonight at the Nasher Sculpture Center. You can find information about that at nashersalonseries.org. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is choreographer Bill T. Jones. He's in town to address tonight's Nasher Salon at the Nasher Sculpture Center. Bill, what's the relationship between art and desire?
Art and desire. Oh, what a lovely question. Hope I can do justice by it. I believe that everything starts in a kind of a primal state. It's everything, literally. Our whole movement and agency in the world starts in a way with a need. A desire. Now, art, I'm often quoted as quoting myself and saying, art does for me what religion traditionally did. It organizes a seemingly chaotic universe. So there is a desire to understand what's going on. Art gives me agency. It says, you can find the language, you can find the means, and you will find an audience. That's a lot of faith that goes into that, what I just said there. But that's how I understand how I'm going to stay in this world, because sometimes it's not easy at all. And I think it's pointless. I don't want to live. It just makes no difference. The world doesn't need another artist. But I have this desire to belong. I have this desire to participate in what I call the big dance. Now, you're a mother with children, and I have no children. But I have this desire to procreate. A friend of mine was Dominican. Monk once said to me, I was asking him about the vow of celibacy, and he said, well, you know, celibacy is not so bad when you realize that you get in return fecundity of another sort. There's so much to be done here. Do you want to participate? And that's my feeling, participation. Participation in the world of ideas is another way of describing art. I have this hunger for ideas. I'm an alienated man. I'm an African-American born in 1952. Brown versus Board of Education was 1954. I grew up hearing stories of oppression in a world that, quote, did not want us. And yet, the people I was surrounded by, they sang all the time. They told stories. They were constantly striving. They had this sense of engagement. They wanted, they had a desire to live. I have that as well. And my art now is what maybe a gift I've given to myself, the means of which I can achieve my desire.
Are you a different person as a consumer of art as you are as a producer of art?
Yes. I think I'm a very good audience. I have great patience. I am a good student, maybe too good a student of visual arts. I'm a great label reader. I really move slowly through and I try to learn about things. I truly believe that every work I see deserves that I give enough time to it to, quote, crack it, to crack its code. Don't you love it when you see something that immediately appeals to you and you immediately engage in it? When I encounter work, as I do more and more these days, I don't understand a lot of visual arts these days. I have to say, well, because you don't understand it does not mean there's not something here to be understood. So study it. So yes, I'm a good audience for art. As a creator of art, unfortunately, as time goes on, more and more in my own field, it seems to, I'm interested in less. And I'm not proud of that. There was a time when I was a young dancer, choreographer, every scrap written about dance I would read. I could just go and watch people take classes because I was so interested in it. Now I have to really struggle. I have to struggle because I feel like my taste is hardening what I like. And I'm not proud of that. That's why it's good to work with people who are so much younger than I am.
Do you envy their youth ever?
Envy? Well, I guess if one can envy people who don't see what is to come.
You envy naivete.
That's I'm a little patronizing, but it's a kind of innocence. Mm-hmm. You know, many of the people who are, this is something gay men, we talk about a lot, books are written about. We live in a kind of a veil of grief. I'm just reading a book by Andrew Harleran called Grief. It's not a world I like to live in, but how many of us are not here? A whole generation of people were decimated, wiped out. And those of us who are here have to, one, not succumb to survivor's guilt, two, not self-destruct out of despair, three, move on, make new relationships, find new engagement, four, stay in touch with that part of you that is eternally youthful and optimistic. That's a big order. It's a very big order.
Who has influence today over what contemporary dance gets produced and staged and seen?
Yes. Who has influence over it today?
Yeah. Is it a money thing?
It's the art market is very much with us in every discipline. And who has the money to commission new works? Who has the interest in commissioning new works? Who has the stages that can really meet the very, very ambitious demands of people working today? The demands of the people who work on the stage today would make what we were doing 20 or 30 years ago laughable. We expect first-rate sound systems. We expect first-rate floor surfaces. We expect sophisticated lighting. We expect professionalism in all the advertising. It's a lot of things that we did not expect when I came into the field in 1971. So I think that the producers are very, very important right now. They are the persons who really keep the thing alive. And they are the bridge. The producers and the presenters are the bridge between the artist working and that many-headed hydra we call the audience. How do you do it? How do you get people interested in something that they feel, many of them feel they don't really need to know about? That is the game of marketing, without losing yourself in marketing. Marketing is a necessary evil. Branding, is that a bad word? Who wants to be branded? But we live in a culture where people trust recognizable brands, if for no other reason, that they know them and that they are familiar with them.
I read something about your company doing an ad for, was it Puma Sportswear?
Oh, no, no, they've been wonderful. Puma people have been so great. Yes, we've done now three things. We did a print campaign, and then we have just completed a commercial. I don't know when it will be aired with a wonderful team, Late Nights and Weekends. That's what they call the producing company. And now we're doing another print campaign with them as well. Yes. Good for the dancers. They really, it helps their pocketbook, but also a lot of them have these ideas that they could be doing something commercial outside of dance, and then they go in there and they realize how hard they have to work and how, in a way, how uncreative it is, you know, because the director is where the creation is. It's not in what they do.
But they still need to eat, so they've got to find something to do.
Yes, yes. I'm glad we were able to provide it for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How does it work when it comes to casting and choosing people for your company? I have to imagine you have a limited number of spaces that you fill. Oh, is it every year?
Yes, more often than I would like. You know, I think a person, I don't think we've had in my history, which is now approaching 25 years, this is 25th anniversary actually, maybe I've had one or two, maybe three people have been there for 10 years. The average age now is somewhere between, I should say actual average time in the company is somewhere between 3 to 6 years. And it takes almost 3 years just for me to understand who they are. And by the time they're in their sixth year, now you see a mature man and woman on stage and not someone who is an apprentice. And then they want to move on. They want to go have a child. They want to go do their own work. They want to travel. They want the dance world. They don't want to tour. And then you start all over again. There's another talented, young, bright-eyed person there who is saying, give to me, feed me, make me fabulous. And then you start the arduous work of making an artist. Now, there are some who are already artists when they come, but many of them, they need the opportunities to become an artist. I wish it were different. And, you know, what about the other end? What about somebody who's been in the field for 15, 20 years? Somebody who has stories to tell, who can teach. They want a retirement plan. Maybe they want a yearly vacation. Maybe they want a solid middle-class life. It's hard to get that in the dance world. Not impossible. Something that my board of directors and my executive director and many people are working at. But it's not in the culture, it's not really in the stars for most performing artists and dancers in particular.
You happen to be in Dallas at an interesting time in our history. Mm-hmm. Certainly the city has made greater strides in the past few years at trying to make this really a center for the arts. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on whether or not that process has to be organic as opposed to something that is sort of overlaid by very well-meaning people, very generous people who've
simply
decided.
You mean like the
decided.
French?
Yeah. You can talk about the French.
Yeah. Oh, I have great respect for the French. I mean, they really believe in a kind of top-down decision-making around issues of culture. They say that those of us whose job it is to know say that culture is as important as highways and hospitals. And therefore, we will set aside money, we will make sure our artists are taken care of, and they've done a good job of it. Now, they also, like the rest of us, are feeling the crunch right now, globalization, all of that, and paying the bills. But they have set a high standard. And I think every community should be graced with cultural leaders who actually lobby for just that. The people don't always, and this sounds like a terrible thing coming from an old lefty like me, the people don't always know what is good for them, what vitamins they need. And therefore, they need informed persons. Now, mind you, not arrogant, elitist, but informed persons who have a deep understanding of the human psyche and human society as an organism, who know you must have a first-rate museum. You must have the correct people observing. You need a critical mass of good critics. You do need to have, within a couple of hours of you, some facility where they can go and see, if they're not in your town, really first-rate live performance with people who have given their lives to that on every level. I think this is very, very important to having a healthy society. And from what I hear in your town, you have a lot of that in abundance right now. I'm not sure about your critical establishment, but I know that the architecture is there, the will is there. You have a new opera house coming, I hear, a new theater coming.
It's very exciting. Yeah,
it's all very going exciting, up. Very exciting. It says a lot about maybe the people who are running this place. My hat's off to you.
Do you have long-term goals for the rest of your career?
The rest of my career.
You imagine the rest of your career is the rest of your life? Do you see yourself quitting in 15 years?
Yes, I know what you mean. There was a time when we used to laugh and joke, say, artists don't take vacations. Artists don't retire. You just evolve into another stage. And I think I feel that on some level, except on my bad days. My bad days, I say, look, you've won a lot of awards. You've proven to yourself and to important people that you can do it. Why don't you just go now and read a good book? You know, go do something. Go do something for other people. You know, I'm not done yet. There is still this person who has something to prove inside. This person who is still, as you used the word before, desire. I have this hunger. And everything in my life I translate into pictures on the stage. So that says something to me. All of my questions, my spiritual questions, my needs, I always see how would I express that if I were to do it with dance? That says something to me that I should stay true to this, should stay in there. Young people, we want a permanent home. I want to have a teaching program. I don't want to just let these dancers leave. I want them to come back and, when they learn something in the world, come back and help us build an institution. I want to mean something to the society when I leave here.
Bill T. Jones is a choreographer and co-founder of the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company. He will appear tonight at 8 at the Nasher Salon event in Dallas. Bill, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.